Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics, nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini, McDermott, Will, and Schulte, and Rich Lenkov from Downey & Lenkov. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. President Trump can cross another political rival off of his list. New York Attorney General Letitia James has now been indicted for mortgage fraud, fulfilling a long-held goal of the client, I suppose, Donald Trump in this case. She's charged with two felonies related to the purchase of an investment property in Virginia, one count of bank fraud, one count of making a false statement on a mortgage application. And here to dive into that with us is Duncan Levin, managing partner at Levin & Associates. He's also former federal prosecutor specializing in money laundering and asset forfeiture.
Nice to be with you guys. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Of course, you know, since the story broke about a week ago, there's been an avalanche of other Trump legal stories. We're going to focus on this one now because this is in your wheelhouse. Just walk our listeners and viewers quickly through sort of the elements of these two felonies that are alleged against the against Letitia James and what the prosecutors must prove.
Well, I mean, these are really straightforward felonies. If you got rid of all the political motivations and the fact that it's a political rival of President Trump's and all of that, and he stripped it away. The case itself is just two counts. It's a count of bank fraud, and it's a count of making a false statement to a financial institution. And it really all revolves around a home purchase that Tish James made in Norfolk, Virginia in 2020. So she submitted a mortgage application or some sort of related loan documents that basically said that this property was going to be a secondary residence, or at least not an investment property. And as a result of that, she got more favorable mortgage terms. The indictment claims instead that she rented out her home. And so they basically are saying that by misrepresenting the occupancy or use status of the property, that Tish James obtained favorable loan terms, that she got lower interest rates and better underwriting that she would not have been available. The entire amount that she is alleged to have saved is about $19,000 over the entire life of the loan. So we're talking about a very, very small amount of money, particularly by the standards of the federal, the Department of Justice. And so it's a pretty straightforward case. And then what they need to show is just that her representations were false and that she did it to get the lender to act.
So, Duncan, how do prosecutorial discretion and possible political motivation here, which we know is involved, how do they shape your view of how this case is going to evolve?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that the case has a clear backdrop of political tension. I mean, she's been a prominent prosecutor as the Attorney General of New York, of very high profile figures, but she's really targeted Donald Trump and the Trump organization. And so, you know, the notion that this is a quid pro quo, that this is tit for tat, is obvious to anybody who's watching. It doesn't mean that she's innocent, she didn't do it. It doesn't mean that she's going to win. It doesn't mean anything about the case, but I think that lurks in the background. I think also the fact that the U.S. attorney in Virginia, a guy named Eric Seibert, reportedly believed that the evidence was insufficient and resigned under pressure is pretty significant, because it basically underscores the role of discretion in deciding whether to charge. And so it raises questions about whether the case was brought, you know, sort of purely on legal merit, or there was a political context to it. And so prosecutorial discretion means that the office would choose, it could choose not to charge, even if the evidence is weak. I mean, the choice to charge here invites scrutiny, and I think in terms of how fair it is.
Like, I mean, you prosecuted these kind of cases. How common is it for the DOJ to go after mortgage fraud? I mean, that is a thing. That is, you know, that's something they pursue. But for this amount of money, would this happen had it not been for the fact that she is the New York Attorney General, one who ironically got a win against the Trump organization for, guess what, defrauding banks and overstating the value of property?
There's absolutely no doubt that that is what this case is about. It's obvious to anyone who's watching it. The fact that it's $19,000 is so significantly below the threshold for anything DOJ would ever bring that it makes it clear that this is being brought because of who she is. She's got defenses there in terms of it being a retaliatory prosecution. But I think that that the amount of money itself is very significant because it's so tiny. But also on the facts themselves, there's evidence that she, in fact, did not rent out the house, that she let her niece live in the house. And so and I think that was part of the reason that the previous prosecutor didn't want to bring the charges, because not only is it below the threshold of what they would take, I don't think the facts, as far as it's been publicly reported, even support what's in the indictment.
Duncan, what broader lessons could this set for future mortgage fraud cases involving public figures in particular?
I think we're descending into a world where people are going to be, politicking by indictment. It's distressing. And I think it is going to weed out a lot of people who otherwise might go into politics. You know, Justice Jackson, Robert Jackson, was the attorney general before he was a Supreme Court justice. And about 100 years ago, he made a very famous speech called The Prosecutor in the halls of the Department of Justice. And he said that, if you look hard enough at any person, you're going to find a technical violation, that you'll be able to find some grounds to prosecute them. And I always say to clients who come in who've been caught and they say, this is so unfair. And I say, you know, think about all the times you did something and you didn't get caught. And thereby the grace of God go so many of us who have made little technical violations, or have committed crimes, or are not living the most perfectly squeaky clean lives. And I think if you look at pretty much anybody on the street and you ripped apart every document that they had, you might find something. And so it really does a disservice to our whole society that this is what we've devolved into.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we've heard this quote a million times now from Stalin, show me the man, I'll find you the crime. It seems to be what's going on, not just with Tish James, but with people like former FBI Director Comey and John Bolton, right? We've seen those high profile retribution, just call it what it is, retribution cases. I'm just curious, like, from your perspective as a former, you know, assistant federal prosecutor, like, what do the rank and file prosecutors think? I mean, they obviously, like, they have to fall in line and they have to follow their leadership, which is pursuing this retribution. But at some point, don't they, we've seen some examples, but don't the rank and file prosecutors say, enough's enough. This is not what we signed up for. We're not just going to, you know, prosecute people because they're enemies of, and it's all out there, right? I mean, Trump just pardoned Santos because he said he voted Republican. I mean, what the hell is going on?
It's so demoralizing. I can't tell you the number of people I've spoken to who are both currently in DOJ and have left DOJ who are, I think demoralized is the right word. And you have, you know, really rogue prosecutors now being put in. I mean, this prosecutor, Lindsay Halligan, who has replaced Seibert.
Insurance lawyer.
She has absolutely no experience whatsoever. Janine Pirro, who was put in New Jersey with absolutely no, in DC, pardon me, with no, experience in this regard. The people that have been put in who are really just loyalists to Trump, I think it's really demoralizing to everybody who's there. And then when you see the types of cases that they're not only bringing but dismissing, and let me throw into that the mayor of New York, the Eric Adams case, where they dismissed those charges, and then he started going on Fox News talking about helping with some of the deportations. I mean, I think that the fact that this has turned into a political arm of the White House is something that most career prosecutors didn't sign up for. And there are a lot of phenomenal prosecutors at the Department of Justice who are career, civil servants who are there to try to bring cases without fear or favor. And this is not what they signed up for. And I think the morale is low, but I think you're seeing all of these resignations by people who have been there for 20, 30 years, who are just unwilling to do President Trump's bidding when it comes to this.
So, Duncan, my last question here is, if you were defending James, how would you go about it? Would you fight the charges head on, or would you push for an early resolution?
No, I mean, this case is going to go to trial. The evidence, first off, has key weaknesses. I mean, I think that the career prosecutors declined to charge her because there was no probable cause. The amount of the benefit, $19,000, and the occupancy question that I talked about, which is that she didn't even rent it out, I think would make a jury very sympathetic, very sympathetic to the idea that this is just a paperwork error, that it's not a deliberate fraud. Given her public role, I would say if I represented her that a plea or an early settlement would be perceived as an admission of guilt. It would hurt her office's credibility. It would hurt her future political path. And I think by fighting, she's going to expose the prosecutorial process. She's going to show these allegations of political motivation. And I think she'll be able to frame herself as a victim of prosecutorial overreach. And so I think it's going to pay off publicly, even if the legal risk is higher. So I would lean towards fighting. And I think at the end of the day, I think there's a very high likelihood that a jury is going to see this being a paperwork error, and that the prosecution's not going to be able to establish that she had intent to defraud these lenders over a very tiny amount of money, where I don't think that she even meant to misrepresent it to get a more favorable rate. I just think that the whole case flops on its face when it gets in front of a jury.
Duncan, really quick, maybe 60 seconds, just pushing back on the monetary amount for a second. Isn't it persuasive to a jury to say it doesn't matter what the amount was? She's the chief law enforcement officer of a major state, any state, and it doesn't really matter how much she defrauded. She committed a crime. Assuming that they prove that, doesn't the amount not really matter in that sense?
I think that she was just going to argue that it's such a tiny amount of money that she would have to be the world's stupidest criminal to, risk all of her, being the attorney general, risk all of this to get $19,000. It's such a tiny amount of money. It makes a lot more sense that she didn't have the intent to defraud them over that amount of money, that it was just a paperwork error.
We're going to have to leave it there. Duncan Levins, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face Off.
Thanks for having me.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, the greatest team in football history, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Face-Off podcast on social media and WGNradio.com. Well, Vanderbilt football is relevant again, believe it or not. An antitrust lawyer is actually being credited with helping Vandy rip off one of their best football starts in the college's history. And what do you know? The lawyer is here with us to talk about it. Ryan Downton is managing partner with Texas Trial Group. What's that about? Thanks so much for coming on.
Sure. Well, Texas Trial Group is that I spent 20 years in Austin before I moved to Puerto Rico during COVID. And so now I run Texas Trial Group from Dorado, Puerto Rico.
Well, Ryan, it's a pleasure to have you. We're really excited to get into this topic because, as Ryan, the other Ryan, mentioned, you know, this is the golden era of Vanderbilt football. They were once the doormat of college football, certainly of the SEC. They're now the 10th ranked team in the country, coming off, I think, the biggest win, the biggest home win in history, right? Beating LSU at home last weekend. You're a double Commodore. I know you went to undergrad and law school at Vanderbilt. And like Ryan mentioned, it's not hyperbole. You are being credited in many circles as a key figure in turning around this football program. Explain to us your involvement, and particularly with your representation of Diego Pavia, who is having a great season. He's the quarterback. You were integral in allowing him to play for Vanderbilt. I think he's, you know, right now maybe the second or third front runner for the Heisman. So really great story. Tell us how you got involved and what the backstory is before we get into the legal part of it.
Sure. Diego is incredible. I hope he does win the Heisman this year. I think he is the best player in college football. And without him, Vanderbilt football would not be ranked anywhere close to 10th in the country. What he can do, I think, for both Vanderbilt's coach and then Missouri's coach this week, both called him a magician, the way he can get out of trouble and improvise. And it's great to see. And that's really how I got involved in this case, that my wife and I watched the Vanderbilt game from Puerto Rico last year against Alabama. And Alabama is ranked number one in the country, and Vanderbilt won, which, of course, shocked the world, including us. My wife also has a legal background, and we were discussing what we believe are antitrust problems with the NCAA and said, hey, Diego would be the perfect plaintiff to challenge some of the issues surrounding junior colleges and the redshirt rule. We went from there.
Let's stop there. Yeah. What is that rule? Explain why you took that on. What is that rule?
Sure. So there are two different topics, two different places we're attacking. The first is the junior college rule. If a kid graduates from high school and goes to prep school, it doesn't count against his NCAA eligibility. If a kid joins the military, it doesn't count against eligibility. If he goes and plays professionally in a different sport, it doesn't count. If he goes on a religious mission, it doesn't count. But if he goes to junior college, the NCAA counts every year of junior college against your eligibility for NCAA athletics. Even though you're not part of the NCAA, you're not seeking a four-year degree, and you don't have a meaningful opportunity to earn revenue for your name, image, and likeness, or NIL. And we believe that's an antitrust violation.
Why is that, in your mind, legally an antitrust violation? What was your argument before the court?
Sure. So the NCAA has a monopoly, or really a monopsony, where they control the market for Division I athletics. And when you're in a monopoly position, you've got competitors making horizontal agreements to restrain trade, which is undoubtedly what we have here. All of the schools in the NCAA have agreed amongst themselves, we will not retain junior college players to play for our schools beyond 2 years, essentially. And so they've taken a segment of the population, the relevant market interested in playing Division I sports, and they've reached an agreement amongst themselves to exclude those players. In most industries, that gives you a per se antitrust violation. College sports is a little different, like professional sports. It would not exist but for some horizontal agreements. And so you don't have a per se violation, but you've got a violation under the rule of reason. And that's your standard for antitrust analysis in most cases. First, you've got to determine, is a restriction commercial in nature? And we've had a big fight about that. If it's not, it's not subject to antitrust law. If a restriction is commercial, it is. So then is three-part burden shifting analysis. Is there restraint? If there is, then the NCAA has to show a pro-competitive justification. And if they can, we have to show that they could achieve the same result with a less restrictive rule. And so that's the framework the courts are looking at.
So you want an injunction, right, allowing Pavia, your client, to play. What was that? Where did you bring that? Where did you seek injunctive relief from? And what was that argument like?
So we filed in the Middle District of Tennessee in Nashville. That's where he's playing, where Vanderbilt University is. We had oral argument, and I had my co-counsel, Sal Hernandez, from a firm in Nashville. And then the NCAA brought in lawyers from D.C., L.A., and Indianapolis. So we had a whole courtroom full of people. And, of course, Diego was there. A number of his linemen came to watch oral argument, which was great to have that support.
You need to intimidate a little bit, too, right?
You know, if we could scare the NCAA with the number of football players, I think we'd probably already have resolved our class action. But so it was great to have all of those guys in the courtroom. And The argument went really well. The judge, Judge Campbell, is a chief judge for the Middle District of Tennessee, clearly knows college sports. He was very engaged and he had done his own research. At one point, he asked the NCAA lawyer, "Do you know Snow College?" And he didn't. I didn't either. It is a junior college in Utah. And so the judge told the lawyer, "Snow College, a junior college in Utah." "Well, okay, Judge, what's the significance of Snow College?" "Well, did you know Snow College played New Mexico Military Institute, where Diego played?" "No, Your Honor, didn't know that." And again, still thinking, "Why? What does this have to do with the case?" "Well, did you know Snow College also played the Air Force Military Academy Prep School that same year?" "No, Judge, didn't know that." "Well, what's your explanation, NCAA, for why the kid who played Snow College at a prep school, he keeps all his eligibility, but Diego, who played Snow College at a different junior college, he loses a year?" And then the NCAA said, "Well, Your Honor, maybe we should look at restricting prep schools." Mm. And the judge kind of throws up his hands. He's like, "No, that's not where I'm going at all." Judge also pressed them on the concept of 5 years to play five seasons, what we're seeking now in the Patterson case. And he said, "Are you going to do that voluntarily? Because if you're about to do that, well, then Diego's got another year. I don't need to do anything." And he asked for briefing on it. And eventually they came back and said, "Well, someday maybe, but not anytime soon."
So, you know, we're in a different landscape now, both legally and in terms of the sport, than we ever have been, with college athletes being considered employees in some respects, with NIL money, with the transfer portal. How do you see your fight in this case translating to the overall picture of college athletics, given everything I just talked about and given your victory?
I think it's important on a number of fronts. The first is to establish that NCAA eligibility rules are commercial in nature. They can't duck antitrust law by saying we're just determining who can play, because who can play determines who can make money. And the Sixth Circuit recently, they threw out the NCAA's appeal as moot, but they gave us two concurrences, one of which said that explicitly, that if you could just recharacterize any rule as eligibility, Alston, the seminal Supreme Court case that paved the way for athletes to get paid, wouldn't exist. So I think we've helped establish that. And then I think we're trying to help create a framework. We're not saying that eligibility should be unlimited or that the NCAA can't have rules. But right now, there is no legal framework as to what rules are acceptable and what rules aren't. We think 5 years to play at an NCAA school is a reasonable restraint on trade that would pass antitrust muster. We're not challenging it. We are saying within those 5 years, you shouldn't tell some athletes, "Well, 1 year, play four games, sit on the bench till the regular season ends, and then you can come back for the playoffs." That doesn't make sense. And so we're trying to help establish a legal framework.
Ryan, I know you're a passionate Commodores fan. You're a double Commodore. I know that also when you went to school there, you were a member of the cheer squad. How much did you utilize your cheer squad experience in your advocacy on behalf of your client in this case? Did it come in handy at all?
You know, other than being able to talk loudly because I got used to yelling at a crowd, I'd say it doesn't matter all that much. But it does keep me connected to the Vanderbilt Athletic Department. And I am a big fan. My wife and I have a suite at the football games. We have floor seats at the basketball games. And we don't live in Nashville, but we come to as many games as we possibly can.
It's sweet. After this victory, they auto erect a statue of you. Forget all the other players, not many of whom are statue worthy at Vanderbilt, but they need to erect a Dallin statue outside the stadium, perhaps.
Thanks. I think a Diego statue is probably more appropriate. And who knows, if he gets the Heisman, then I would think that should definitely be happening.
That's quite a commute and quite a fan to come all the way from Puerto Rico to check out Vandy football. By the way, Rich, is this the first LFO guest that we've had from Puerto Rico?
I think it might be.
In 10 years?
No, I think it could be. Yeah, we're everywhere. You know, San Juan and all over the place.
And it's always good to have another Ryan on board. Ryan Dunn, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Faceoff.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off with Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini. I'm Ryan Breaux. Another school is joining the AI wave, requiring AI certification for first-year students. We have someone from that school here on LFO. John Anderson is dean, and Henry Vaughn Watkins and Selby Watkins McRae, professor of law at Mississippi College School of Law. Thanks so much for coming on with us.
Absolutely. Grateful to be here.
Dean, as Ryan mentioned, your law school, the Mississippi College School of Law, just recently became the second law school, with Case Western being the first, to require AI certification for its first-year students. Why has your school decided to take that step?
Yeah, well, Christina, this we're on the verge of a major transformation as a society, but also in the practice of law and legal education. And the reality is that these tools and their power as a force multiplier for practicing attorneys and in legal education and preparing for the practice of law just can't be ignored. And, you know, the reality is that, you know, whether you're going to be a transactional attorney or whether you're going to be a litigator, you're going to be using these tools. And the firms are going to be expecting that our students have familiarity with these tools when they step into their summer clerkships and when they step into practice. And they're looking to us to prepare them for that. So I feel like we really need to be able to send a signal to these firms, to these employers, to these judges in their chambers, that when they take an MC Law student on, they can expect and be certain that these students will have competency in these with these tools and with these technologies.
So, Dean, just give us a couple examples of what is involved in this mandatory certification. And also, you know, I was curious, like, does it replace the traditional first year programs like mandatory legal writing and research? You know, are those still relevant even if you are getting certified in AI as a law student?
No, absolutely. Yes, Rich. I mean, this certification program is going to be inserted as a module within our legal analysis and communications course, right? So we actually have a called LAC. So LAC 1 in the fall semester, mandatory for all 1Ls. LAC 2 in the spring semester, mandatory for all 1Ls. And then we have an LAC 3 that is in their 2L year that is mandatory course. So these are our kind of what used to be referred to as legal writing courses, right? But they're broader than that. They're not just teaching writing. They're also teaching other skills. And so what we've decided to do is insert the AI certification program. It's kind of like a boot camp, right? An intensive boot camp over two days into our LAC 2 course in the spring semester. So students will have this fresh in their memory and have these tools kind of newly minted in their tool belts before they head out to their summer clerkship opportunities that summer, right? So it's part of a legal writing program that all of our students will go through, but there will be a separate certification exam at its conclusion. You ask what it includes. It's basically four 1.5-hour sessions, supplemented by about 2 hours per session of outside class work. So we're probably looking at like 15, 16, 17 hours of intensive AI training. And this will be reinforced before and after in that LAC course. But they're going to have that certification. And these four sessions are, the first session is going to be introduction to AI and large language models. So the students will get a basic introduction to these technologies, how they work, you know, what makes them tick. And then they're going to learn best practices in the next session, best practices for using and prompting AI models. And then in session three, they're going to learn the ethics of the use of these models and these technologies, right? So I'm sure you're all familiar with kind of the headlines of attorneys who are misusing these tools, and even some judges, right, who have in their chambers, whether it be their clerks or otherwise, have misused these tools. And so we need our students to understand, one, their power, as I said earlier, is a force multiplier, but the risks of improperly using them. So they have to understand how to use them effectively, efficiently, but ethically and responsibly. And that's what we're going to do before they go out to that practice.
So, Dean, this initiative is also in tandem with your recent launch of your Center for AI Policy and Technology Leadership. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about the center and what the goals are with that?
Yeah, well, you know, the reality is that the state of Mississippi is really looking to lead the way with respect to AI and machine learning, and they have received many billions of dollars of recent investment from Amazon, AWS, and others with new data centers here in Mississippi. We've got the space. We have the energy, and we have the other resources that some of these larger tech companies are looking for. And so we're looking to lead the way. And as part of that, the state leadership wants to signal to industry leaders that we also have the infrastructure. We have a legislature that understands these technologies. We have a court system that understands these technologies. And we have firms and other supporting, and a workforce that understands and can be familiar with these technologies. So what they were looking for is a location to house a policy and leadership center for with respect to AI and machine learning. And what better place than MC Law for that? We're located literally a block from our state capitol, two blocks from the Supreme Court. The governor's mansion is two blocks in the other direction, right? We are right here at the center of everything, but also the state's largest law firms, federal courthouses, et cetera, et cetera. So we're right in the middle of all of this. And these leaders are teaching our courses here at the law school. We're interacting with them regularly. We're a trusted resource for them already in other spaces in the law. So I think that the state, in granting us this funding for this new Center for AI Policy and Technology Leadership, just recognize that, hey, geographically we're situated well, but we also are going to have the expertise and the credibility to be able to inform our leaders so that these AWS and others can come in here and say, yeah, we know what we're getting from Mississippi, and they're going to be informed, and the policies that are going to be implemented are going to be well informed.
Dean, how do you balance, and I'm sure it's a challenge, I'd love to hear your perspective, how do you balance the ability to foster critical thinking that is in the traditional law school model that is part of the Socratic method and the back and forth involved with professors and going to a book and researching, going online researching, doing some writing with, on the other hand, the ease of use of AI and the simplicity in coming up with an answer without having really to use your brain. Let's face it, you can type in a question and get something that would take you traditional people like Tina and I, dinosaurs, hours and hours to come up with. AI can do that in a second. That's a good thing in many ways. We want to promote efficiency in legal work, but how do you marry those two seemingly competing concepts?
Yeah, no, it's a tremendous risk, right? As you point out, it's these technologies can be kind of addictive, and they can become a crutch. They can become a shortcut, and by bypassing that learning process. If we don't use these technologies responsibly, we're going to produce a less effective attorney. There is no doubt about it. And one thing that AI will never be able to replace is the ability to QC AI itself, right? And if you're just using AI to give you answers without having the background and the broad understanding of the law and that foundational education, you're never going to know when AI gets it right or gets it wrong, right? So the reason we're implementing this early on and adopting this early on in our students' legal education is so that they understand, right, that these technologies have limitations. They have uses that will allow them to kind of amplify and make some of their lawyering skills bionic, right? But there are tremendous risks, and you cannot, the bar exam is a marathon, and you can't train for a marathon by driving 26 miles, right? So if that's kind of going to be their approach to using these technologies, we want them to learn early on that's a recipe for failure, and they're going to put their firms at risk, they're going to put their clients at risk, and they're probably not going to get past that bar exam. So we have to kind of inform them of that, educate them on that early on. That's part of why we want the certification early. So they know the power and the risks and what this can't do and what it can't become, which is a shortcut or a brain calculator for being a lawyer. Also, we want to teach our students and emphasize the things that AI is not going to be able to replace. Reading a room, understanding and managing your client's expectations. Right, being able to think critically and creatively about solutions that your client may not see or expect, right? That can resolve an issue or create an opportunity. So these kind of intangible elements that human creative and critical thinking brings to the table, and just that kind of personal interaction. That's what lawyers are need to be in person and to be doing. And so we're leaning into that. We're emphasizing that and emphasizing those, the importance of those lawyering skills, while at the same time teaching them how to use these technologies effectively. So you can emphasize what these technologies can't do in our other areas of teaching and practice. And make sure that when they are using this skill, these tools, they're doing it ethically and effectively.
The last question we have time for is, do you have any plans to replace whoever's teaching this class with a chatbot? Much like on this program, we used to have a real Ryan Burrow host. Now we have a chatbot version of Ryan Burrow. It's remarkably lifelike, but any plans to replace your professor with...
And cheaper.
Okay. Well, I look forward to maybe a year from now renewing this conversation, because I am looking into a holographic box for one of our classrooms so that we can have an AI avatar for our professors and have them holographically appear in front of them as a way of kind of toying with these technologies and giving some visibility into the future of education generally. Imagine having Abraham Lincoln in front of you teaching you the Emancipation Proclamation. So these are some exciting opportunities, some fun things that we might be able to do. And our Center for AI Policy and Technology Leadership is going to help lead the way here in our state, but in the nation, in kind of exploring some of these opportunities.
Well, there's no such thing as an AI dean, so I think you've got some job security right now. Dean John Anderson, thank you so much for coming on with us.
All right. Thank you so much. Grateful to be here.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN, and it's time for the Legal Grab Bag. We're joined today by repeat guest Tiffany Hughes, the founding partner of the law offices of Tiffany M. Hughes, where she focuses on family law in Florida. And we have Lance Ewing, the VP of Enterprise Risk Management for Cotton Holdings, Inc., originally from West Tennessee, correct? But you're based out of Texas now.
I live in West Tennessee. I'm originally a Pittsburgh boy.
You're all over the place. Well, he said he's also got a whole lot of Holiday Inn Express points racked up, so we'll hopefully be able to use those at some point. All right, we start with Trump Watch. And Rich, this week, a big focus on troop movement in Portland, also in Chicago.
Yeah, I mean, competing decisions by federal courts. We were going to discuss another late-breaking Trump legal story coming out yesterday, which is like we just talked about Trump a little bit. Where did you guys hear about Trump now asking his Department of Justice to pay him $250 million to settle his allegations of prosecutorial abuse, you know, in between presidencies? We know that his home was raided. He's asking the DOJ to give him $250 million of taxpayer money. That's a pretty good story. The other one that Ryan referred to is, on Monday, the court in the Ninth Circuit said that Trump does have the discretion to order National Guard, Tina, to Portland. They didn't really address the question of whether this was, you know, as Trump has described it, a hellhole and in need of, you know, troops on the street. But the ultimate question being decided in the Chicago case, in this case, that the Supreme Court will ultimately decide is how much discretion the executive branch has in deciding things like this. And the trend has been to give him broad discretion, right? We know this very Supreme Court ruled that you cannot prosecute a president for actions done while they're in office. I bet the Supreme Court, when they decide this kind of case, is going to say, listen, he's the chief executive, he is the commander in chief, and if he deems it appropriate to send troops to an American city, even though a lot of courts have held that they don't agree that there's this imminent threat, he has the power to do so. That's what this court basically held.
George, I agree with you that he's probably going to be given pretty broad discretion here. I think tying it to a federal interest, a compelling interest, is probably not going to be that tough, especially when you've got, you know, a court that may be wanting to look for it. Another breaking Trump legal issue is his taking a wrecking ball to part of the White House and whether he can do that within his own discretion or not. So I think that we should talk about that at some point, too.
Oh, yeah. Lance, what was your reaction to
those two stories go together, right? He's suing DOJ for $200 million. Someone's got to pay for the ballroom, right? I mean, it's dancing with the DOJ. That's what you got to do. You got to have that.
Yeah, that's right. Tiffany, what are your thoughts on Trump continuing to flex? I mean, he also posted, you know, a bunch of crazy AI videos after the No Kings rally where he is literally dumping feces on the protesters. You can't make this stuff up, right?
I mean, is this reality? Is this the world that we live in? I mean, the fact that, like, do we not have a constitution anymore? I mean, I think the dissent said it best when they said that it erodes the core constitutional principles, right? Like the sovereign states have control over their militia, the First Amendment rights. Like Trump's in office and now all of a sudden we don't have a constitution, or I think it's crazy.
And he seems to be wavering because I think he is cognizant of, I mean, it's hard to say, but he is cognizant of the fact that you can't just send troops in on his discretion. He is now saying that it's to protect federal officers, ICE. So he is sort of walking that line between sending them in just as a police power, which I think is broadly considered unconstitutional, to coming in to protect federal assets, which clearly is within his authority.
Certainly reminds me of the teenager who's pushing back on the parents at this point in time. That seems to be, and he's a petulant child occasionally.
No, really?
I'm stating the obvious. I apologize related to that.
Maybe so. You're saying that Trump is immature. I find that shocking.
What would Thomas Jefferson say? We'll save that for another show. All right. The Louvre is back open after a crazy and pretty embarrassing break-in earlier this week. Rich, this story's actually been one of the top clickers on most of, well, News Nation's website, WGN's website. People can't get enough of this story.
I was watching today. They hauled in the head of the Louvre, this woman, in to testify before, you know, the France legislature, because, I mean, man, this is the friggin' Louvre, right? It's the most popular and most visited and really the most important museum in the world. I think I saw one stat, Tina, where in one wing, 70% of the floor had no cameras, 60% in another floor, and 60% in another. I mean, this one did actually show these guys breaking in. Their brilliant criminal strategy, let me think, it was to wear a vest, a yellow vest, and pull up a ladder. Like, is this like 1925? They literally drove a truck up to the Louvre, put up a ladder, an old school ladder, used a hammer to break in a window, and then grabbed a bunch of jewels. Like, this is not a thief as much as it is like a 1950s heist movie. Haven't we evolved where we have security? I don't know, maybe a guy just watching the windows? You know, maybe like a no ladder, a no truck and ladder policy on the grounds of the Louvre. I'm just spitballing here, but perhaps this security was a little lax for the most precious. And they got some pretty significant stuff, right? They grabbed a bunch of jewels. They grabbed Napoleon's wife's, the last empress of France. They grabbed the crown and they left the crown. Much like the Kim Kardashian story we covered a little while ago, where the old bandit.
Or do they drop something else?
No, they drop the diamonds on the floor. These idiots dropped the crown, but they made off with a lot of, you know, really important French jewels.
Yeah, I don't get it, Rich. I mean, there's a lot about it that I don't get. And I just think that as this story continues to evolve, it's going to go like in a worse direction. You know, I definitely think that there's a possibility that that this was an inside job. I just don't understand how you can possibly, with the most famous museum in the world, with some of the most famous, priceless works of art, jewelry, etc. I mean, it's like you're running like some sort of ma and pa, you know, corner shop with the security that this place had. It's just I'm speechless.
Lance, are the French just doomed to be forever surrender? No. Like, surrender is in the war, surrender sissy robbers. Come on in, it's okay.
There is breaking news that just came across. The French have put Inspector Clouseau in charge of doing this, Mr. from the Pink Panther. He's now in charge of the entire investigation. You've got $88 million taken in crown jewels in 7 minutes. Now, you want to talk about a return on investment. That's a hell of a deal for $88 million. And they have no insurance, of course, right? Because the federal government, the France, they're in charge of the insurance, so they're self-insured. My understanding, though, is that the criminals did take those crown jewels, took all that stuff. They did leave dogs playing cards on velvet out in there next to the Mona Lisa. So,
oh my God, that's amazing. Tiffany, where were they? Where were they fenced these? Where were they got rid of, like, Napoleon's jewels? You can't just walk into, maybe you can, a pawn shop in Paris and say, I've got these like $11 million worth of brooches and rubies, but I don't know. Maybe you break
right. them up. I mean, that's what I was thinking. What do you like? How do you like then sell this? You know, like you go in with like another guy and you guys are planning this whole robbery and then you drop the crown and here we are. And then you have all these jewels. And then what exactly do you do with them? I mean, somebody
strip
like
them what's, for you parts. Know, yeah, like a car. Yeah. Parts.
Like Tina's right. I mean, I think it's an inside job. And I think that somebody's going to be in some obviously serious trouble with the fact that there's not 70%, Rich, you said, like, not everything is on camera. And like, how is this possible with maybe something?
Maybe invest in a $20 ring camera for somewhere in the living room. Right. Did you know, speaking of the Mona Lisa, which was like a few, you know, steps away from this, it was stolen in 1911, inside job. One of the guys, this is a 1911 story. The guy waited until dark. Took the Mona Lisa out of its frame, put it in his trench coat, and walked out of the building.
There was a nearby horse waiting for him. Yeah. Yes. By the way, in this has got to be the next Ocean's movie, right? And I did a quick, so yeah. We've got Ocean's 11, Ocean's 12, Ocean's 13. Then there was an Ocean's 8. So we'll have to, you know, someone get...
Ocean's 42.
So someone get Brad Pitt on the phone. Let's get this moving. All right. Here's a name I thought I'd never say again. K-Fed. He's spilling the tea on his divorce with Britney Spears. Rich is taking us into a time warp back into the mid-2000s.
Yeah, well, we want to get the expertise of Tiffany on here. But Tina, K-Fed came out with a book. I don't know why he's come out with a book now, right? He's about 15 years past his relevant date. But some revelations that came out in his book from the divorce. He was awarded $20,000 per month in child support and another $20,000 in alimony. They were married 26 months. So he got about $1.3 million. Doesn't seem like a lot. We'll get Tiffany's take on that in a second. But you know, he said it's expensive to live in LA with two sons. One of the revelations, Tina, was that Britney hasn't spoken to her sons. Like, you know, we remember the images of her and her sons. They seem pretty close. I guess one of them she hasn't spoken to in 5 years. They don't really speak. And, you know, she came out with her response, which I think was preceded by dance moves. Like, she always releases these dance moves with knives and stuff. And then she explained that it wasn't true. But what do you make of these KFED divorce revelations?
Well, I think that he knows he's irrelevant. I think he's probably self-aware enough to know that, you know, no one talks about him anymore. And so to get himself back, you know, in Google search results, he decided to, you know, come out with this book. And I'm sure that any book he sells, it's more about people trying to get the scoop on anything relating to his ex-wife, more so than about him. And so anyway, I mean, he's a has-been, he knows he's a has-been, and this is the way he tries to make himself relevant again.
Tiffany, this is money, you know, 20 years ago, but it doesn't seem like a lot from a Britney Spears, who was at the height, really, or near the height of her influence and earning capacity back then. 20,000, 40,000 total a month doesn't actually seem, it seems like a lot to us, but it doesn't seem like a lot in that celebrity world.
Yeah, I was actually kind of surprised by the fact that it was such a low number. But maybe, you know, KFED was like really killing it with like the backup dancing. You know what I mean? Like he was also like in the height of his, you know, prime. I mean, the guy definitely is trying to be relevant and the money ran out. So now it's the time to try to make a buck because he's got nothing left. I think he said he was going to invest it. He was supposed to. He never did. He blew through it. I mean, this guy, did he ever work again? I mean, it was enough money for him to literally do nothing, right? I mean, obviously he's taking care of the kids. That's a job. But like, other than that, he never worked outside of the household, right?
Well, he's a highly sought after backup dancer, as is Lance Ewing. That's how we met. Lance, what are your thoughts on these breaking?
You know, I mean, here's a 47-year-old guy who can't seem to get his stuff together, if you will. I mean, he did create an album, Tiffany, after called Playing with Fire. There's a link there related to Play, which was the worst album ever that came out. Literally was the worst album ever on that side, right? You know, and again, you know, to us, I mean, Rich, you come back with, hey, not really a lot of money on that side. I'm sorry, we're in the legal profession. She had a better lawyer than he did, apparently, right, on that side. So I'm sorry for your luck. You chose poorly. I'm sorry.
And a prenup, you know, presumably, right?
Yeah. And in my world, you know, in the insurance geek world, there is divorce insurance. You may or may not be aware of that. But in this case, it wouldn't apply due to the fact that you have to be married 4 years before the divorce insurance policy will kick in at this point in time. So he needs to plug in, you know, another few months with Britney, and then maybe he could file for divorce insurance. That might work.
All right, so KFED is on Cameo, guys. Yeah. There is an opportunity here. I'm trying to see how much he is. I'll have to get back to you on that, but we could get a message from KFED. We really want to.
Maybe the next introducing voice to the podcast.
And it would help him out. Would help him out too, right? I mean, get the exposure, get the money. So something to think about. All right. Push the World Series starts on Friday, so let's talk some baseball. Tina, you threw this story into the bag for us. It takes us from the Little League field to a New Jersey court.
All right. And so this is a case of a 12-year-old Little Leaguer in New Jersey who was just so excited when he hit a home run in the sixth inning of a game that would send his team to the state championship playoffs. You know, he did what any reasonable kid or even adult who plays baseball would do. He ran the bases and then he tossed his bat in the air. Unfortunately, an umpire decided to eject him from the game for doing that. And under the Little League rules, once you get ejected, you're required to be suspended for an additional game. Well, his dad, Joe Rocco, just happens to be a lawyer and decided to take matters into his own hands and hired a law firm to send a demand letter to the Little League asking for them to reverse the umpire's call. That fell through, and so Rocco and his lawyers decided to take the case to court. The basis for doing that was that there was no technical rule that was violated. Apparently, the Little League does not have an explicit rule against bat flipping, which is, for those of you who don't know, is the act of throwing your bat in the air. And the argument was that the Little League actually seems to celebrate bat flips because there's a bunch of video clips on their website and on social media celebrating other little kids and adults doing bat flips. He also argued, and this was a pretty creative argument, but a tough one to win, that there was a breach of implied contract on the basis that the Little League was not following its own rules since there was no rule against bat flipping. The league argued that Rocco's son violated a no horseplay rule and that allowing a reversal here would encourage more litigation by overzealous parents who are trying to get umpire rules reversed. The case was heard in July. The judge ruled in Rocco's favor, reversing the umpire's call and allowing his son to play in the next game. Needless to say, Rich, the Little League was not happy with this ruling, saying that there were a lot of resources that were expended taking this matter to court and that they're worried about getting volunteers in the future for Little League games if they are going to end up in a situation where they're in court trying to defend things like umpire calls.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting story. It was an important game. We'll show the video here, and then we'll talk more about it. Here is the home run. It was a really nice shot by this kid. Let's play it. Bang. And here's
the wow, flip. That's a great hit.
A great hit. Yep. Here's the flip. There it is. So, a couple things. Do you know what happened, Lance, to the team in the next game after he was granted the right to play?
They got
mercy rule. They lost 10-0. You know, I play basketball a few times a week. You know what happens when you make a BS? You make a BS call the next play and you miss a shot. We say ball don't lie. Right. In this case, ball don't lie. Right? They went to court to whine about this umpire's complaint, and they got mercy rule. That's what's called karma. So I like lawyers. I like lawsuits. I'm a lawyer myself, but I'm also a former coach. I'm going to be, a basketball referee at some point here. Come on. Yes, there was no express rule saying no bat flip. You know, there's also no express rule for like pulling down your pants and taking a piss on the base path. That doesn't mean that you do it. Some things you don't do. Now, listen, in their defense, you're right. The league itself touts bat flipping on their video. Major league players. We just saw the greatest game in the history of baseball by one player. Shohei Ohtani on Friday pitched 6 scoreless innings, 10 strikeouts, 3 home runs. The greatest single performance perhaps by any athlete. Guess what? He flipped the bat. So when kids see the major leaguers doing this, it's understandable. Whether that should go to court rather than leave it on the field is a different question. I hate these activist parents who are screaming and yelling. I've dealt with it my whole athletic career. Shut up, follow the ref, follow the right thing. Unless it's egregious, keep it between the lines and don't go to court to protect your kid because you have failed, aspirations of being a superstar. But interesting story. Tiffany, what's your take on it?
I think the league and I think the dad both went in like really extreme directions, right? Like, why couldn't the league said, look, okay, we don't have an express rule. You should have known better. You didn't, you obviously didn't. And here's a warning, right? And then the dad was like, okay, well, now I'm going to take it to the court system and I'm going to sue. And they issued a demand letter and it wasn't settled. And it's like, why can't we all just get along and just meet in the middle? You know, when the demand letter was sent, it's like, give him a warning, let the kid play. And the timing of it is crazy. I mean, obviously the game was it was irrelevant. It was moot at that point. The main game he wanted to play in, he couldn't play in. So
what's worse? You look at this and Major League Baseball actually has 11 minutes every single year, the top bat flips. In a YouTube, for goodness sake, right? And you're trying to emulate bat flips. I'm a Pittsburgh Pirates fan. Please don't throw anything at me. I apologize, but I have
Do you even have the qualification to opine on anything given that statement?
Yeah, I understand that. But wait, did you see Tommy Pham this year? Pittsburgh Pirate in a 3-0 pitch gets the fourth pitch as a balk, right? Or as a walk, and he flips the bat because he got a walk. Come on. Yeah, really? Are you kidding me?
Hey, Pittsburgh's got to celebrate where they can these days, you know?
Dude, my team takes by All-Star, they're like in the middle. Then they take a bobsled to the basement so fast, it's unbelievable. So
All right, moving on. Rich is going to explain to us this new trend among boomers and probably Gen X couples as well, the gray divorce.
We're going to get Tiffany to really explain this, but, you know, there is a report that we saw that says that there's a rise in the share of divorces for people over 50. It's about 36% of adults divorcing are now 50 and over, according to the study, more than some other groups. And, you know, some of the factors, Tina, I mean, they're natural, right? You don't need to be an expert to know that once you get older, your tolerance for, you know, BS kind of, devolves. Once you see that you've got less years of your life ahead of you than behind you, I think your tolerance for some of the things that drive people apart become less. And also there is, you know, increased monetary pressures. There's increased monetary resources, right? You've got more money. You're nearing retirement. You might be coming into your 401k. You realize that you really want to share that money with someone else you might not be getting along with. But it kind of runs contrary to sort of the, you know, mainstream thought that once you hit a certain, you know, time together and your kids are out of college, this is your life mate. But perhaps people's tolerance is less these days, as evidenced by this study.
Yeah, Rich, I mean, I think it's interesting. I can't say I'm surprised. You know, they're citing the fact that people are living longer and the prospect of, you know, potentially living, you know, another 30 plus years with the person that you just don't think is a good match for you. Especially if you have a financial ability to sort of stand on your own and to support yourself. The reasons that kept people together, you know, historically, I'd say a number of these reasons just, you know, as time evolves, as people evolve, as lifespans evolve, they just don't really necessarily, they're not what drives the decisioning around these sorts of life decisions anymore.
Tiffany, you're one of the foremost divorce lawyers around. Are you seeing more of your clients coming in who are more advanced in life, a little older? And what are some of the factors that we haven't mentioned that are driving this gray divorce phenomenon?
Yeah, well, yes, absolutely. I mean, I've had people from, you know, over 50, even in their 80s, as crazy as that sounds. I think the modern conception of what marriage looks like has changed. And I think now the expectations are completely different. Like now we expect a lot more. We want a friend. We want a partner. We want romance. We want sex. We want help with the household labor. We want help with the children. Like, it's very different than what it was years and years ago, right? So like now people are like, you know what? I'm getting older. I don't have that many years left. And I'm not dealing with this BS anymore. And again, I think the modern conception of what marriage looks like is just different.
Yeah, I think what Tiffany says is 100% true, right? Retirement is a different for everyone. I do think, though, I have a friend of mine who's in the age of retirement, been married to his wife for 30 years. I asked his wife if she was looking forward to his retirement. She says, hell no. And I said, well, why? She said, you know what that is? It's half the paycheck and twice of him. I don't want that in my life. No interest whatsoever. Thank you very much.
And asking for a friend, right?
Yeah, asking for a friend, of course. Yes, exactly. So, but I mean, I see billboards coming in this gray divorce thing. You know, law firms, have you been miserable for the last 30 years, right? Please come to the law firm of Tinder and Bumble and we'll be happy to take care of you. You know, we'll move you in some direction, right?
There's probably an app for that, right?
I think both of them have apps. You're absolutely right.
Specifically for gray hair? Okay. All right. We've got PB&J wars right now between Smucker's and Trader Joe's. Tina, I love them both equally. I can't pick a side.
Very funny. So Smucker's, which is a brand that we're all familiar with, has been around since 1897. It's the well-known brand behind some of the most famous jams and jellies, and is the brand behind the super popular Uncrustables product, which is a crustless peanut butter and jelly product, which is almost at the $1 billion a year in sales. Our viewers who are seeing our who are actually seeing our interviews and our show here can see the side by side of the products. Earlier this month, Smucker sued Trader Joe's in federal court in Ohio, alleging that Trader Joe's new crustless peanut butter and strawberry jam sandwiches are confusingly similar to its Uncrustables product, and claims that Trader Joe's is committing trademark infringement and engaging in unfair competition and deceptive trade practices. So Smucker's alleges a few things in this lawsuit. First, their whole narrative here is that consumers are going to think that that Trader Joe's product is somehow linked to, sponsored by, associated with the Smucker's product. And they're making that claim based on a few things. First, they're claiming that there's a similar blue color that's used in both of the sets of packaging, as well as the sandwich configuration. They're both round, they're both crimped on the side. And they claim that that is going to cause confusion. The picture of the product on both of the packages shows one of the products, one of the sandwiches, having a bite taken out of it. And they think that is going to exacerbate the possibility of confusion. As our listeners know, this is in my wheelhouse. I can tell you that my gut reaction to this is that when you look at the packages themselves, I'm not so sure I'm seeing the confusing similarity here. The wording that is overlapping here is generic wording, meaning that you can't stop somebody using words like peanut butter and strawberry jam sandwiches for the descriptive meaning. So I don't see anything here that shows that they're infringing the trademark Uncrustables. What is interesting is this whole product design argument. Depending on the design, depending on how well known it is, sometimes product designs can trigger intellectual property rights, but product designs can be pretty tricky, Rich, to protect, because usually you have to demonstrate secondary meaning out of the gate. Product designs are usually not protectable here. So this is an interesting one for geeks like me on the trademark side. Obviously, at the end of the day, this is about market share. This is a huge product that they are trying to protect the market share.
I'm so tired of these lawsuits going to the consumer confusion argument. Like, it's one thing if you're arguing that there's a set trademark or a patent on a product, right? Smucker's is saying, for example, that the way the edges are crimped is, like, that's one thing. If you have a patent or a trademark on the way the sandwich is made, that's one thing. But, like, this is not 1920, where I'm going into a grocery store and I think, wow, there's crustless sandwiches. They must be Smucker's. Like, do they think people are that dumb? There's no person on this planet that goes into Trader Joe's and buys that blue box of sandwiches and thinks, this is Smucker's because it looks like there's no way. Similar to all the other stories we've covered where they're alleging that Aldi is ripping off the Oreos. Like, this is a generic product. I think 30% of consumers buy generic products. We get it. They are similar to the original product, but they're different. They're completely different products. They're cheaper. The very essence of it is that they're similar, but cheaper, right? This has been around forever. You go into the cereal aisle, there's like Fruit Loops and like Laffy Loops. No one's confusing the two. There's no consumer, I submit, on this planet that thinks these are the same product. They understand it's a cheaper home, a store version of the one. So, like, let's retire that argument forever, I think, legally. It's stupid. Lance?
Yeah, I'm going to push back a little bit because this is Smucker's building upon their last. This is not the first time this has gone through. In 2024, Smucker sued a company called Chubby Snacks. Now, who the heck thought that was a great name for a company? Chubby Snacks. That was really a good winner on that.
We side. Make you fatter.
It was right next to Weight Watchers. They put the product right next to Weight Watchers, Chubby Snacks. Anyway, they lost. Chubby Snacks lost and went out of business because Smucker sued them and used both the Ohio laws that are there, as Tina brought up, as well as the federal trademark dilution aspect of things. But they're trying to protect their brand. And, you know, I live in Tennessee, so we fight Jack Daniels, dilution stuff all of the time. So, I get where they're coming from to protect their brand, protect the line that they've got. But I tend to agree with you, especially based on, as Tina brought up, if you look at those two packages, it's like, come on, guys, seriously? That looks like a six-year-old drew up the Trader Joe's one, and the other one looks semi-professional, to be honest with you.
Like, it's one thing if you called it Snuckers. Like, I get it. That would be cool. And, like, everything else was, like, the same. It would be incredibly confusing, and you'd lose a portion. But these are really different. By the way, like, Trader Joe's is well-known to only sell their own products, right? Is there anyone who's ever shopped at Trader Joe's who thinks you can buy Smuckers? They don't have it. It's all their own products.
Well, I have a question for the group. Has anybody eaten any of these things?
Yeah,
has anybody tried one? Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I don't like PB&J, so.
Incredibly popular. By the way, there's a whole trend among like NFL players and athletes.
4,300 of those eaten by NFL teams every single week.
Oh, my.
700 alone by the Denver Broncos.
Oh, that's a huge, it's a huge product. It's a billion-dollar brand.
Tiffany, did you want to weigh in?
I mean, Tiffany, yeah, sorry.
First of all, like, I wish I would have created this for a $1 billion market. But, like, do the balance between the two of you guys, Lance and Rich, like, you know, I think, why couldn't they just make a square? You know, or make a triangle, or like instead of taking a bite out of like, you know, the side of it, like why not like just maybe like show the middle of it? You know what I mean? Like, obviously, Smucker is going to come after them. They're dipping into their $1 billion profit. And you know, and that's a big problem. But I don't know. I mean, I kind of see the similarities, but I also get what Tina's saying. And like, you know, I don't know. I think it is going to be very difficult.
So the key is you put them in the freezer and you let them get nice and hard, and then you put them in your wherever, and then wherever you go later, they're a little bit hard still, but they're that's my pro tip for you. You want to freeze them.
Try the Trader Joe's version, Ron?
I have not. We need to do that. We need maybe next show. We'll put that down on the list.
Blind taste test.
Yeah.
All right, let's wrap it up, Tina. We've got a name game going on in Houston involving some lawyers.
Yeah. Wild. Now, Ryan, this week has spent all afternoon talking about this, but high level, there is a firm known as Push and Nguyen that has been embroiled in a lot of battling between the two named lawyers. There's fraud that was alleged. This has been going on for months. And of course, now it's entered into trademark territory, which is where I come in. So the firm recently rebranded. Nguyen is out. Pushed Nguyen out, pun intended. And now the firm is rebranded to Push and Win. Push apparently went out and found a guy who has a name, last name that's very similar to Nguyen. And so, you know, this has been in court, Rich, for a number of weeks now. Under the order, Nguyen, the old partner, is shut out of the firm. He is blocked out of the computer systems, online accounts, and he is not able to use some of the firm's trademarks, including some cute slogans that they developed to play on their last names, We Push You Win and Avocados at Law. Nguyen was given until October 31st, so Halloween, interesting choice of dates to transfer the trademarks. Push is ordered to remove Nguyen from the website. I think that these are super cute, actually, these ads. And they apparently have phased out the firm name and gotten rid of the Nguyen name, but substituted in Nguyen. But apparently this guy Nguyen is still on the website. What's interesting here, there's a lot of different details to this, but Nguyen is claiming here that the rebranded firm, which sounds a lot like the firm name when he was part of it, is confusingly similar because Nguyen sounds like Nguyen, and that he is claiming that the firm is trying to capitalize on the reputation that was developed under the old firm name. Push argued what I would argue, which is that no one owns rights to either any of the phrases that use and leverage the term Nguyen. And that also there are a bunch of people who have the same last name as Nguyen, and actually they're lawyers too, and they play off of the name. So, you know, what's interesting here, Rich, is that I think that, you know, we've talked about this before. Entities like law firms often own assets. And when one partner leaves, the ownership usually stays with the firm that is left behind. And so I don't think there's much to dispute here unless somehow the ownership was a little bit different with these guys. What I find the most interesting angle here is that Nguyen is trying to argue that the new firm name is confusingly similar to the old firm name. Just because someone has a last name doesn't mean that they can use it as a trademark. A great example is if you have the last name Wilson and you want to use it on sporting goods, you can't because there's already a Wilson for sporting goods. But this has actually been getting quite a bit of press over the last few months since the whole fraud case started. So interesting. I love this avocados at law ad. It's pretty cute.
Yeah. Which win wins, right? Is the best thing. It's I love the fact that they just swapped in one guy whose name was Win with another guy whose name is Win, just spelled differently, right? They pushed out that guy. There's the new firm, Push and Win. And they're trying to convince the judge that they hired this other partner now named Win legitimately. I mean, is it that easy in Houston to find like a name partner to join your law firm that replaces the other guy named Wynn? It's just kind of bizarre. And I think we should have more, Lance, you work with a lot of lawyers. I think we should have more law firms that whose titles are also verbs, you know, like Bill and Bill would be great. Like, you know, cheap. I don't know.
Yeah. You know, law firms splitting up are a lot like Brittany and Kevin, right? I mean, we just went through that deal. So, you know, it's always interesting. Our company's headquartered here in Houston. So we see the billboards all the time, Tina, around in different places like that. I'm not sure I want to pick my law firm out of a produce aisle. I'm just being honest. It's just not my DNA. But I will tell you down here, and I think the hearing is tomorrow. I think there's a hearing down here tomorrow for that on that side of things. All the lawyers down here were like, get your popcorn. This is going to be exciting. We're going to watch this happen, right? So,
hey, Lance, you should go to the hearing and then report as our correspondent.
I actually could bring my own popcorn and sell it down there at the hearing. I should do that.
Lance Ewing reporting for Legal Face-Off.
Yes.
Tiffany, don't forget to bring your avocados, Lance, and sell those too.
Well, Tiffany, you split your practice between Illinois and Florida. Florida is the land of legal billboards. You can't drive a quarter mile without seeing a billboard. What's your take on this one?
I mean, I think it's very convenient that this guy's last name is Wynn. And did we ever confirm that that's really his legal name? Because, right? I mean, that could be a thing. Or did he maybe change his last name? Because I think it's just very interesting that this particular, I mean, obviously when you're picking a partner in a law firm, you're going into a marriage, right? So the fact that he found this particular person conveniently that has the last name Wynn, I don't know. I think it'd be interesting to see if this guy's last name is really even Wynn.
Yeah.
Tiffany, have you ever considered finding someone whose last name is Colors to go into and you could do Colors and Hughes or something like that?
I mean, I think that'd be great. I think my head maybe in an avocado would look pretty nice.
Maybe someone
maybe that's what it is. Lawyers just gotta partner together so that they can find names that work, that lock together.
And get someone whose name is either Lamp or Breakfast to go with your law firm. All right, let's finish off. We like to spring a question on everyone based on our topics. And I was just thinking, I was going to do another one, but we mentioned the avocados of law. I'll start off by naming something that is very popular food that I have absolutely no time for, which is, shockingly, avocados. I do not like avocados at all. I don't like guacamole. I know that's shocking to a lot of you because it's a very popular food. Tina, name something that is very popular to eat that you do not like at all.
Rich, I don't know if you knew this, but you and I share the guacamole and avocado thing. And I'm half Mexican. And it's like, it is just, my brothers think that I am a slight on the family because not only can I not stand avocados and guacamole, I can't stand salsa. Don't like it? Dude, yeah.
All to me. I'll take it.
Mucho caliente take on that one. Lance Ewing, what is a popular food that you don't like that makes you a freak?
I'm not a Brussels sprouts person. I mean, I've had them dipped in cocaine. I've had them dipped in honey. They try to get me to eat them all the time. Me and Brussels sprouts.
Standards and practices are quickly deleting that comment, but that's a good one. Tiffany, what is a popular food that you have zero tolerance for?
Okay, you ready? So I wanted to get a pig, like one of those miniature pigs, yeah, until I realized contractually that they couldn't guarantee that the pig was going to stay miniature, right? But like I had fell in love with this pig. They're very smart. You can train them like dogs. And so I can't eat pork because of the little pig.
Well, you got one.
No, I didn't. No. Because they couldn't guarantee that I wasn't going to have this like 300-pound potbelly pig. So I never got the pig. But the whole thing really like made me think about the fact that it's like a family member and like, so I can't eat pork now.
Yeah, I thought you would go the other way and be so angry that you couldn't get this pet that you eat as much and bacon as possible. Retribution. Ryan Burrow, go.
I am not a meat eater, but everyone keeps pushing portobello mushrooms on me. I do not like those. Don't give me your portobello mushroom burgers. I'm not interested.
You like mushrooms at all, Ryan? No. Or is it just
I used to
you're like my
mushrooms.
Brother. My brother can't do them.
I've grown to like mushrooms, actually. Lisa, anything that is popular among other people that you do not care for?
Any kind of seafood.
Really?
I can't.
Mm-mm. Anything with eyes, anything with a head.
Well, I do eat meat.
And also, by the way, this will shock you. I have never tasted coffee in my life.
Really?
Not a coffee drinker.
Wow. Really?
Never tasted coffee.
I didn't know that.
Absolutely.
Wow. Now it's just a game for you, though, right? Now it's see how long you can hold out.
Bananas, tomatoes. I get a lot that I can't stand. You guys like bananas? The mushrooms. Yeah.
I do, but they have to be a certain, like if they're overripe, I can't stand them. They gross me out.
They can't be mushy.
I have with guacamole.
You have a texture problem, Rich.
It's a texture issue.
Yeah.
I hate peaches with the fuzz on them. I'm a nectarine guy all the way. I can't handle the fuzz on the peaches on my tongue.
Oh my God.
Oh, I'm dead.
Wonderful. Well, with that, why don't we wrap it up? Thank you very much, Lance Ewing and Tiffany Hughes. That'll do it for this latest installment of Legal Face Off on WGN. Special thanks to attorney Ray Downton, Texas Trial Group, John Anderson, the dean and professor at Mississippi College School of Law, and Duncan Levin, managing partner at Levin & Associates. Also, shout out to Ben Anderson, Lisa Stegel, Fortina Martini, Rich Lenkoff. I'm Ryan Bro. Thanks
special
again for joining
announcement.
Us.
Don't forget our special announcement.
Oh, wait. Pause.
Happy birthday.
Thanks, everybody.
29.
Yes, thank you. It's never felt better being 29.
We have an 80s graphic there.
No, it's very Saved by the Bell.
And as long as you're not saying it's an 80s picture and it's just an 80s graphic, I'm okay with that.
Well, happy birthday, Tina.
Thank you, everybody. I appreciate it.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget.